in The Roaring Girl, as well as reprising my role as Dominic Clark in Latin, with John Davis still in the part of Herbert Brookshaw. Simon Cherry would be directing once again, and he had asked David Lewis, a history of art student with whom he shared rooms in Queens, to design a poster. The result was sensational. In the style of an Edwardian children's storybook jacket, Dave's design depicted a school-uniformed boy and a young man in a teacher's gown kissing, with a cricket game going on in the background. It was stunningly well done. The lettering, the colour palette, the whole look of it was exquisite. It shocked, but it was also funny, elegant and charming, which is what I hoped the play might be. The Mummers producers, Joe and David, sent an army of volunteers, in other words, the cast, around Edinburgh as soon as we arrived to staple and paste up the posters for all our shows wherever we could. It soon became apparent that the Latin poster was in great demand. The moment it went up, it would be pinched, even if we took the common precautionary step of ripping it first to decrease its collectability. I started to get messages left for me at Mummers' headquarters in Riddle's Court, offering money for spares. It had become a collector's item. In a rare burst of entrepreneurial PR zeal, I called up the Scotsman, pretending to be upset that our poster was being stolen as soon as it was put up. Sure enough, they obligingly ran a small paragraph with a picture of the poster under the mini headline, "Is this the most stolen poster in Edinburgh?" The box office went through the roof, and Latin was sold out for the whole of the 2 weeks of its run. Latin played in the mid-afternoon, but the main evening attraction was The Roaring Girl. One of its cast members was a handsome and amusing Trinity Hall undergraduate called Tony Slattery, who had the look of a young Charles Boyer and the habits of an ill-trained but affectionate puppy. He read modern and medieval languages, specialising in French and Spanish. He had represented Britain at judo, becoming national champion at his weight in his teens. He sang and played the guitar and was capable of being most dreadfully funny. Every night, in his role as some kind of foppish lord, he would put a larger and larger feather in his hat. By the time we came to the end of the first week, it was brushing the ceiling. The entire cast, including Annabel Arden, who had the lead role of Moll Cutpurse, fell into unrestrained giggles each time he executed a low bow, which caused this enormous plume to bounce and waggle over our heads or into our faces. Sometimes, when actors corpse, it amuses the audience. But when it goes too far, they often start to stir and mutter and hiss, which is what happened that evening. It was deeply unprofessional, but being deeply unprofessional was one of the marvellous things about being students and being, well, not professional. We all squeezed into digs somewhere in the new town, hunkering down in sleeping bags on the floor, and even managed to make room for my sister Jo, who came to visit and got on very well with certain members of the company. It was a wonderful time. The plays were all successful in their own way, and we attracted good audiences. The pleasure was compounded by excellent reviews. The notoriously difficult Nicholas de Jong was blush-makingly nice. Stephen Fry is a name I shall look out for in the future, which is more than could be said for most of the writers and performers on the fringe, he wrote. I have since been a sore disappointment to de Jong, I think, but at least we got off on the right foot. Even better news came when the Scotsman awarded us a fringe first, the award that everyone aspired to win in those days. There was little time to see any other shows. Electric Voodoo, this year's Footlights Review, was composed of completely different performers from the year before. Hugh Laurie, that tall fellow with a flag of crimson on each cheek, wasn't in it, nor were Emma or Simon McBurney. Emma did come to Riddle's Court to see Latin, and she brought the Laurie chap with her. "Hullo," he said, when she pushed him forward to meet me after the show. "Hullo," I said. "That was very good," he said. "I really enjoyed it." "Thank you," I said. "That is very kind." The triangles on his cheeks flamed redder than ever, and he popped off. I didn't give him much more thought. Conveniences. In the late September of 1980, I arrived back in Cambridge for my final year. Although we could each have had a single set again, Kim and I decided that we wanted to carry on sharing, and we were allocated A2 in the medieval tower of Old Court, the finest undergraduate rooms in college. Many graduates and dons had accommodation far less grand. The rooms boasted magnificent built-in bookshelves, a noble fireplace, an excellent gyp room and bedrooms. The windows looked out on one side over Old Court and on the other onto the Master's Lodge of St. Catherine's, the abode of the august professor of mathematics, Sir Peter Swinnerton Dyer, who was currently enjoying a period as vice-chancellor. The most prized item of furniture we added came in the form of a mahogany table that cleverly opened up into a wooden lectern. I had borrowed this from Trinity College as a prop for a lunchtime reading of the poems of Ernst Jandl and had somehow failed to return it. Kim added his Jake chess set, Bang & Olufsen stereo, Sony Trinitron television and cafetiere coffee jug. We were far from the great age of designer labels, but brand names were beginning to acquire a new significance and desirability. I owned a pistachio-coloured Calvin Klein shirt, whose loss I still mourn, and a pair of olive-green kickers of such surpassing splendour that I sob just to think of them. On the ground floor at the foot of our staircase, a smaller set of rooms had been taken over by the college and transformed into something quite marvellous and strange and new. A ladies' lavatory. The outer room was fitted with a large dressing table with bulbs around the side of its mirror. On this table were boxes of coloured tissues, a glass jar of Q-tips, and a pretty painted porcelain bowl filled with powder blue, baby pink, and Easter yellow balls of cotton wool. A basket-weave chair, freshly painted in white gloss, was tucked into the valance or pelmet of flower-printed chintz that underhung the table. On the pink-painted walls were three different coin-operated sanitary towel and tampon machines. In the lavatory itself, a complex incinerator for used examples of same stood next to the toilet, and hanging off the back of the door could be seen a thick swatch of brown Lillette's disposal bags. The whole place screamed, "You are a woman! Don't even think of forgetting it!" Queen's College, after 532 years of single-sex status, had decided to go co-ed. Women undergraduates had arrived this term as full members of the college. I can picture the scenes at the meeting of the college's governing fellows. The president coughs for attention. "Gentlemen, as you know, this body voted 2 years ago for women to be..."
"I didn't, nor I!"
Yes, thank you, Dr. Bantry, Professor Threlfall. "A majority of fellows voted for the admission of women. Next term, as you know, we'll see our first intake. Will they eat with the rest of us?" "Well, of course they will eat with us, Dr. Kemp. Why on earth shouldn't they?"
"Well, I thought they ate differently."
"Differently?
They pick up their food with their mouths, don't they? Or am I thinking of cats?"
"Dr. Kemp, have you actually ever met a woman?"
Well, not that you'd... "My mother was a woman, was introduced when I was 7, used to see her at mealtimes occasionally. Does that count?"
"And did she eat normally?"
"Let me think. Well, now you come to mention it, yes, she did, yes, quite normally."
"Well, there you are, then. There is, however, the issue of cloacal arrangements. Women do, of course, have hygienic requirements that are somewhat sui generis."
"Oh, yes? In what way?"
Well, to be honest, I'm not actually sure on this one myself, but I believe every now and again they're required to shout and to slap a man and then burst into tears and, then they have to blow their nose or something and do their hair. Something along those lines. This happens regularly once a month, I'm told, so we will need specially designed rooms set aside for the purpose."
"I knew no good would come of this. Hear, fucking hear! Gentlemen, please, if we can just... And where are they going to hang their breasts at night? Answer me that."
"Excuse me?"
"Women have extra mounds of flesh that they attach with wire suspenders and silk peggings to the front of their chests. I know that much, at least. The question is, where are they going to hang them at night? You see, you just haven't thought this thing through, have you?"
And so on, until the meeting broke up in disarray. With the exception of the startling lavatories, the arrival of the women turned out to be the most natural thing in the world. It seemed impossible to believe that they had never been here before. Whether they took to the more honkingly earthy college institutions like the Kangaroos, the college's sporting club, or indeed to the Cherubs, of which I was now leader or senior member, I cannot quite say. Since, by definition, all the women in college were first years, how they must have tired of the terms freshettes and undergraduates, there were none quartered in Old Court, hence none to use the gleaming ladies at the foot of A staircase. It became, therefore, our private poo palace, which is how I know the towel-bag legend off by heart. Lilettes expand widthways to mould themselves gently to your shape. If you have any questions, write to Sister Marion. Kim and I were lovers by this time, and it was a happy state to be in. He played chess, read Thucydides, Aristotle and Cicero, and boomed Wagner over Old Court, sweetening it with gigantic moments from Verdi and Puccini. I learnt my lines, typed the occasional essay on my Hermes typewriter, read, smoked, and chattered. Friends came up the stairs and stayed for long afternoons of toast, coffee, and then wine. We were closest with Rob Wyke, a graduate from St. Catherine's, who taught in college and worked on his thesis. He had played Gonzago in The Tempest. He, Paul Hartle, another PhD student at Katz, and a third wild and wonderful graduate called Nigel Huckstep formed a triumvirate in whose company Kim and I loved to be. Their range of reference was enormous, but they wore their learning lightly. On free afternoons we would drage, which Nigel, who picked up languages as easily as infants pick up infections, claimed was an Afrikaans word for saunter, past King's, down Trinity Street, and to the Baron of Beef pub in Bridge Street, where the dirt was dished on all of Cambridge. Committees. As a third year now, I found myself on innumerable committees. Aside from being the president of the May Ball, senior member of Cherubs, I've senior member being the obvious chant, and president of Bats, I was on the committees of the ADC, Mummers, and several other drama clubs. This meant that at the opening of term, I found myself bouncing from meeting to meeting, listening to directors, pitching, as we would now say. It went like this. Let us say you are a director, or want to be one. You choose a play, new or classic, you decide how you mount it, prepare a speech about your concept, draw up a sensible budget, and get yourself on the list to be heard by each of the larger drama societies. All this would now be done with presentation and spreadsheet software, I suppose, but back then it was bits of paper and speechifying. At a meeting of the ADC, a first year brimful of confidence arrived. He had the pained, coat-muffled-up look of a sensitive socialist who finds everything around him violent and faintly oppressive. "I am very, very interested in the work of Grotowski and Brooke," he told us. "My production of Sergeant Musgrave's Dance will utilise their theories combined with elements of Brechtian epic. I will dress the cast only in white and red. The set will be scaffolding." Gosh, well, absolutely. We consulted amongst ourselves after he left. Jolly bright fellow. Sergeant Musgrave hadn't been done for 15 years, so far as we could tell. Interesting ideas. Cheap, too. Definitely worth considering. We see a few more candidates, and I rush off to Trinity Hall, where we hold a similar meeting for the Mummers. The third candidate to come into the room to pitch is that same intense first year who had appeared before the ADC committee. He sits down. "I am very, very interested in the work of Grotowski and Brooke," he announces. "My production of 'Tis Pity She's a Whore will utilise their theories combined with elements of Brechtian epic." He breaks off and gives me a look of uncertainty. Has he seen me before somewhere? He shakes his head and continues. "I will dress the cast only in white and red. The set will be scaffolding." A few more candidates and I'm off to Queen's for a Bats meeting. Sure enough, there is that first year again. He really is covering all the bases. "I'm very interested in the work of Grotowski and Brooke. My production of The Importance of Being Earnest will utilise their theories, combined with elements of Brechtian epic," I ask. "Possibly dressed in white and red? Scaffolding?" That first year is now a successful homme de théâtre and an artistic director of distinction. I do not know how many of his current productions are dressed in white and red, but his scaffold-clad My Fair Lady, utilising the theories of Grotowski and Brooke, combined, I'm told, with elements of Brechtian epic theatre, wowed them in Margate last summer. No, but shush. I loathed committee meetings then, and I loathe them now. My whole life has been a fight to avoid them as much as possible, a losing fight. I would so much rather do things than talk about doing them. Those who sit in committee rooms rule the world, of course, which is lovely if that is what you want to do, but those who rule the world get so little opportunity to run about and laugh and play in it. It was a relief, then, to be cast as Volpone in a production at the ADC. A second year from Keys called Simon Beale played Sir Politic Woodby and all but ate up the stage with the most astonishing comic physicality and outrageous upstaging. At one point in the second act, he stood talking to me, his back to the audience. I was always rather mystified why my excellent speech to him got so many laughs. It's unsettling when you don't know where laughs come from. I discovered that Simon Beale was scratching his ass throughout the whole scene. Had it been from an actor less accomplished or a person less adorable, I suppose I might have been miffed. He also sang beautifully and was possessed of perfect pitch. There was a market scene that required singing, not from me, of course, but from the rest of the cast. Simon would stand in the wings, everyone huddled around him, and give out the note. After the performance, as a treat, he would sing Dalla sua pace, or Un aura amorosa, for me, and I would melt into a puddle. One night, the venerable Shakespearean scholar and emeritus professor of English, L.C. Knight, affectionately known as Elsie, was in the audience. He left a note for me at the stage door, telling me that in his opinion my Volpone was superior to Paul Scofield's. Better shaped, better spoken, and more believable, the finest I have ever seen. How like me to remember that word for word. The old boy was almost 80, of course, and almost certainly deaf and demented, but I was nevertheless wildly proud. Too proud to show the note to anyone other than Kim and the director, for my pride in refusing to allow myself to appear boastful or pleased with myself was even more intense than any pride I might have had in my achievements. There was sometimes a fight between these two species of pride, but usually the first type won and was mistakenly called modesty. Early one evening, during the week-long run of Volpone, I arrived backstage at the ADC Theatre and tripped on a pile of boxes in the corridor. They were programmes for the following week's ADC production, dumped on the floor by the delivery man from the printers. The play was Sergeant Musgrave's Dance, the Grotowski Brook obsessive having been duly awarded his slot. I read through his programme notes. Work, discipline, comradeship. Work and discipline and comradeship. Only with these three can we create a true socialist theatre. I took the boxes to my dressing room and hunted for a pen. An hour later, the programmes had been returned to their boxes. The director's notes now read, Work, discipline, comradeship. Work and discipline and comradeship. Only with these three can we create a true National Socialist Theatre. I saw him later that evening looking white and furious and felt that I'd been a hideous beast. But really, I mean, did Shakespeare call actors workers or players? Cycle. The next week, Kim surprised me with plans for an exeat from Cambridge. He had bought tickets for Gertz Friedrich's Ring Cycle at the Royal Opera House in London. Monday das Rheingold, Tuesday die Walküre, Wednesday off, Thursday Siegfried, Friday off, and Saturday Götterdämmerung. A week of Valkyries and Nibelungs and gods and heroes and Norns and giants. It was my first visit to Covent Garden and my first experience of live Wagner. Not my last. Indeed, I was at a Götterdämmerung just a few nights ago. It gets into your blood. Well, my blood, probably not yours. All Wagnerians know the film that descends over the eyes of those to whom they talk about their obsession, so I will say no more save to point out what is perhaps obvious, that it was a shattering experience and a life-changingly important week for me. Comedy colleague, collaborator, and comrade. A far more life-changingly important moment and a yet more shattering experience was heaving to on the horizon. Amongst the friends that came to visit A2 was Emma Thompson. Having taken a year off from the footlights, she was back in the club as vice president for her final year. She arrived one early evening and plonked herself on our excellent sofa. You remember Hugh Laurie? Remind me. She flung an impatient cushion at my head. You know perfectly well who I mean. He was in Nightcap. Oh, the tall chap with the flushed cheeks and the big blue eyes. Exactly. Well, he's the president of Footlights this year.
Cool.
Yes, and he needs someone to write sketches with. He wants me to bring you over to his rooms at Selwyn.
Me? But I don't know him. How? What?
Yes, you do. She flung two cushions in succession. I introduced you at Edinburgh.
You did?
There were no cushions left, so she flung me a speaking glance instead, probably the speakingest glance that had been flung in Cambridge that year. For someone with such a good memory, she said, you have a terrible memory. Kim, Emma and I walked up Sidgwick Avenue towards Selwyn College. It was a cold November night, and the air held a smell of gunpowder from a bonfire night party being held somewhere near the Fen Causeway. We came to a Victorian building on the rugby ground side of Grange Road, not far from Cambridge's newest college, Robinson. Emma led us through the open street door and up some stairs. She knocked on a door at the end of the corridor. A voice grunted for us to enter. He was sitting on the edge of his bed, a guitar on his knee. At the other side of the room was his girlfriend, Katie Kelly, whom I knew slightly. Like Emma, she read English at Newnham. She was very pretty and had long blonde hair and a ravishing smile. He stood awkwardly, the red flags of his cheeks more pronounced than ever. "Hullo," he said. "Hullo," I said. We were both people who said "hullo" rather than "hello." "Red wine or white?" said Katie. "I've been writing a song," he said, and started to strum on his guitar. The song was a kind of ballad sung in the character of an American IRA supporter. "Give money to an IRA bomber, why, yes, sir, I'd consider it an honour. Everybody must have a cause." The accent was flawless, unlike mine, and the singing superb. It seemed to me a perfect song. "Woolworths," he said as he laid the instrument down. "I borrow guitars that cost 10 times as much, but they just don't do it for me." Katie approached with the wine.
"Well, are you going to tell him?"
"Ah, yes. Well, thing is, Footlights. I'm the president, you see." "I saw you in Nightcap. You were magnificent. It was brilliant," I said in a rush.
"Oh, gosh. Well, no.
Really?
Well, Latin. Top. Absolutely top."
"Nonsense. Oh, shush.
Completely."
The excruciating horror of mutual admiration out of the way, we both paused, unsure of how to continue.
"Well, go on," said Emma.
"Yes, so, there are 2 smokers left this term, but most importantly there's the panto."
"The panto?"
"Yup, the Footlights pantomime. 2 years ago we did Aladdin. Hugh was the Emperor of China," Katie said.
"I missed that, I'm afraid," I said.
"Quite right. I would have too, if I hadn't been in it. Anyway, this year we're doing the Snow Queen."
"Hans Christian Andersen?"
"Yup. Katie and I have been writing it. We've got this." He showed me some script. 5 minutes later, Hugh and I were writing a scene together as if we had been doing it all our lives. You read about people falling suddenly in love, about romantic thunderbolts that go with clashing cymbals, high quivering strings and resounding chords, and you read about eyes that meet across the room to the thudding twang of Cupid's bow, but it is less often that you read about collaborative love at first sight, about people who instantly discover that they were born to work together or born to be natural and perfect friends. The moment Hugh Laurie and I started to exchange ideas, it was starkly and most wonderfully clear that we shared absolutely the same sense of what was funny and the same scruples, tastes and sensitivities as to what we found derivative, cheap, obvious or stylistically unacceptable. Which is not to say that we were similar. If the world is full of plugs looking for sockets and sockets looking for plugs, as, roughly speaking, the platonic allegory of love suggests, then there is no doubt we did seem each to possess precisely the qualities and deficiencies the other most lacked. Hugh had music, where I had none. He had an ability to be likeably daft and clownish. He moved, tumbled, and leapt like an athlete. He had authority, presence, and dignity. I had... hang on, what did I have? Patter and fluency, I suppose. Verbal dexterity, learning. Hugh always said that I also added what he called gravitas to the proceedings. Although he had great authority himself on stage, I suppose I had the edge on playing older authority figures. I wrote, too. I mean, I actually physically wrote lines down with pen and paper or typewriter. Hugh kept the phrases and shapes of the monologues and songs he was working on in his head, and only wrote them down or dictated them when a script was needed for stage management or administrative purposes. Hugh was determined that the Footlights should look grown up, but never pleased with itself, or, God forbid, cool. We both shared a horror of cool. To wear sunglasses when it wasn't sunny, to look pained and troubled and emotionally raw, to pull that sneery, snorty, what? Face at things that you didn't understand or from which you thought it stylish to distance yourself. Any such arid, self-regarding, stylistic narcissism we detested. Better to look a naive simpleton than jaded, tired or world-weary, we felt. We're students, for fuck's sake, was our credo. We have people making our beds and tidying our rooms for us. We live in panelled medieval rooms. We have theatres, printing presses, first-class cricket pitches, a river, boats, libraries, and all the time in the world for contentment, pleasure and fun. What right have we got to moan and moon and mooch about the place looking tortured? We were fortunate that the age of young people doing stand-up comedy hadn't yet arrived. The idea, and I'm afraid it has since become a reality, of pained, emo students leaning listless and misunderstood on a mic stand, railing against the burden of life, would be more than either of us would have been able to bear. We were exceptionally attuned to pretension, aesthetic discord, and hypocrisy. The young are so priggish. I hope we are much more tolerant now. Almost no one we ever worked with, either at Cambridge or afterwards, quite seemed to share or even understand our aesthetic, if I can dignify it with such a word. It is probable that our fear of being unoriginal, of looking cocky, of being obvious, or of even being seen ever to have chosen the line of least resistance, caused us difficulty in our comedy careers. The same fears might also have pushed us to some of our best endeavours too, so there is no real reason to regret the sensitivity and fastidiousness that only we appeared to share. We soon became familiar with the expressions of bewilderment that might flicker over the faces of those who suggested something that inadvertently trespassed against our instinctive sense of what could or could not be funny, right or fit. I don't think we were ever aggressive or unkind, certainly not deliberately, but when two people are absolutely in harness with regard to matters of principle and outlook, it must be very alienating to outsiders, and I expect two tall public school figures like us must have seemed forbidding and aloof. Inside, of course, we felt anything but. I would not want to paint a picture of us as earnest, dogmatic ideologues, the Frank and Queenie Leavis of comedy. We spent most of our time laughing. The smallest things would set us off like teenagers, which, of course, we had only just stopped being. Hugh had come up to Cambridge from Eton College as a successful international youth oarsman, having pulled himself through the water to gold with his school friend James Palmer in the Coxless Pairs event in the Junior Olympics and at Henley. Back in the 30s, his father had been in a winning Kenridge Blue Boat for each of his 3 years and went on to row in the British Eight at the Berlin Olympics of 1936 and again in the Coxless Pairs in the 1948 London Games, where he and his partner Jack Wilson won gold. Had glandular fever not struck, Hugh would certainly have rowed for the university straight away, but denied by his illness a seat in the Blue Boat for his first year, he looked about for something else to do and found himself cast in Aladdin and then, 2 terms later, Nightcap. In his 2nd year, he abandoned the Footlights and did what he had come to Cambridge to do, pull that rowing boat through the water. On the river by 5 or 6 in the morning, hours of back-breaking rowing, then road work, gym work and more time on the river. He got his blue in the 1980 boat race, which Oxford won by a canvas, the closest result there had ever been. You can imagine the disappointment. How many times he must have revisited every yard of that race in his head, upping the stroke rate by 1 beat a minute, just 1 neater piece of steering on the bend, 2% more effort at Hammersmith. It must have been heartbreaking to have come so close. I tried to tell him that my own experience of losing to Merton in the final of University Challenge meant that I knew exactly how he felt. The look he gave me could have stripped the flesh from a rhinoceros. The following year, his last, he could either stay with rowing or return to the Footlights, but he could not do both, president of the Cambridge University Rowing Club or president of the Cambridge Footlights. He claims that he tossed a coin and that it came down footlights. He had gone to Edinburgh and seen Latin and decided that perhaps I might be a useful new recruit to his footlights. Only he and Emma were left from the first year, and he needed fresh blood. Kim was co-opted onto the committee as junior treasurer, Katie was secretary, Emma vice-president, and a computer scientist from St. John's called Paul Shearer, a funny, lugubrious performer with eyes almost as big as Hugh's, was already on board as club falconer. This strange office went back to the days when the footlights were quartered in Falcon Yard. I don't believe there were any duties attached to being falconer, but it looked good, and I envied Paul's title sorely and reprehensibly. Continuity and Clubroom. There is perhaps one overriding reason why the Footlights has produced such an astonishing number of figures who have gone on to make their mark in the world, and that reason is continuity. The Footlights has a tradition which goes back over 100 years. That tradition inspires many with a comic itch to choose Cambridge as their university. The Footlights has a regular schedule, a pantomime in the Michaelmas term, a late-night review at the ADC in the Lent term, and the Mayweek review at the Arts Theatre, which then goes on to tour Oxford and other towns before arriving in Edinburgh for the Fringe Festival in August. And throughout that year are peppered smokers. The word is an abbreviation of smoking concert. I dare say smoking is no longer permitted at these public events, but the name has stayed. In our time, smokers took place in the club room. The fact that the club had its own little venue was another of the inestimable advantages held by the Footlights over comedy groups in other universities. The closest equivalent to a smoker in the outside world is an open mic evening, I suppose, although in our day there was a small filtration system in place, so open isn't quite the word. Anyone from any college with hopeful sketches, quickies, songs or monologues would come to the clubroom the day before the smoker and exhibit their material on the stage. Whichever committee member was running that smoker would yay or nay them. If a yay, their piece would be added to the running order. The auditions would go on until there was enough there for an evening's entertainment. The huge advantage of this system was that by the time the Mayweek review came around, there was a lot of material to choose from and plenty of performers to pick, all of them having been tried out in front of an audience. In most other universities, they don't have that kind of feeder system. Josh and Mary at Warwick or Sussex might say, "Hey, we're funny, let's write a show and take it to Edinburgh. We'll put Nick and Simon and Bernice and Louisa in it, and Baz can write the songs." They're probably all very funny and talented people, but they won't have the year's worth of practice and experience and the cupboard full of proven material that a Footlight show can call upon. That, in essence, I believe, is why year after year the club continues to do so well. It is why their tours always sell out and why young people with a feel for comedy are so often disposed to put a tick next to Cambridge in the university application form. The Footlights clubroom was a long, low room under the Union Chamber and had a small stage with a lighting rig and a piano at one end and a sort of bar at the other. All along the walls hung framed posters of past reviews and photographs of past footlighters. In their duffel coats, black polo necks, tweed jackets or wind cheaters, with studious black-rimmed spectacles perched on their noses and untipped cigarettes between their lips, they all seemed so much older than we were, so much cleverer, so much more talented and a world more sophisticated. They looked more like French left-bank intellectuals or avant-garde jazz musicians than members of a student comedy troupe. Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, Bill Oddy, Graham Garden, John Cleese, David Frost, John Bird, John Fortune, Eleanor Bron, Miriam Margolyes, Douglas Adams, Jermaine Greer, Clive James, Jonathan Lynn, Timbrook Taylor, Eric Idle, Graham Chapman, Griff Rhys-Jones, Clive Anderson. "The tradition stops here," Hugh and I would mutter as we looked up for inspiration and found our gaze meeting theirs. Such a tradition, such a rich history as the Footlights, was in part inspiration and encouragement, but in part insurmountable obstacle and impossible burden. Neither Hugh nor I seriously thought for a moment that we would have a career in comedy or drama or any other branch of show business. I would, if I scraped a first in my finals, probably stay on at Cambridge, prepare a doctoral thesis, and see what I could offer the academic world. I hoped, in my innermost secret places, that I might be able to write plays and books on top, under, or to one side of whatever tenured university post might come my way. Hugh claimed that he had set his eyes on the Hong Kong police force. There had been one or two corruption scandals in the Crown Colony, and I think he rather fancied the image of himself as a kind of Serpico figure in sharply creased white shorts, a lone, honest cop doing a dirty, dirty job. Emma, none of us doubted, would go out and achieve her destiny in world stardom. She already had an agent, a forbiddingly impressive figure called Richard Armitage, who drove a Bentley, smoked cigars, and sported an old Etonian tie, had signed her onto the books of his company, Noel Gay Artists. He also represented Rowan Atkinson. Emma's future was certain. None of which is to say that Hugh and I lacked ambition. We were ambitious in the peculiar negative mode in which we specialised, ambitious not to make fools of ourselves, ambitious not to be called the worst footlights show for years, ambitious not to be mocked or traduced in the college and university newspapers, ambitious not to look as if we thought ourselves pro-y, show-busy stars, ambitious not to fail. Within 2 weeks of meeting, we finished the Snow Queen script. I also wrote a monologue with Emma for her appearance as a mad, unpleasant and foul-smelling wise old woman. Katie was cast as the heroine, Gerda, while Kim, ascending to the role of pantomime dame as if born to it, played her strikingly Les Dawson-like mother. I was a silly-ass Englishman called Montmorency Fotherington Fitzwell, 9th Earl of Doubtful, who by happy chance never sang. Australian-born Adam Stone from St. Catharines played Kay, Gerda's boyfriend. Annabel Arden had the title role of the Snow Queen herself, and an extremely funny first year called Paul Simpkin played a kind of dumpling-faced jester. There was a talented young man called Charles Hart, whom we put in the chorus. He later came to fame, and frankly not inconsiderable fortune, as the lyricist for Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera and Aspects of Love. Greg Snow, a howlingly funny friend from Corpus Christi, was in the chorus too, alternately amusing and exasperating Hugh with his astounding camp and a talent for bitchery that approached high art. Hugh had a hand in the music, and I had a finger or two in the lyrics, but most of the composition and arrangements were the work of an undergraduate called Steve Edis, whose girlfriend Kathy Bell danced and sang in the chorus like a demented can-can girl, despite her devastating susceptibility to severe asthma attacks. The pantomime seemed to go well, and by the time Lent term came, Hugh and I were already starting to write material for the Late Night Review, to which Hugh had given the title Memoirs of a Fox. It irked him that no one seemed to get the reference, but it was a fine enough title without having to know Siegfried Sassoon. Titles, you soon discover, are fantastically irrelevant. You could call it, as American Indians were said to do of their babies, the first thing you see out of the window. Running Bull, Long Cloud, or Parked Cars. You could even call it the first thing you see out of the window. Actually, I quite like that. One afternoon, I found a tattered old exercise book in the Footlights clubroom. Scrawled on the cover were the words, May Week Review Title Suggestions. Over generations, members had written down ideas for titles for shows. My favourite was Captain Fellatio Hornblower. I always suspected this to be the handiwork of a young Eric Idle. Many years later, I asked him. He had no memory of it, but agreed that it sounded pretty much his style and was willing to take the credit, especially if there was a royalty in it for him. More or less opposite Caius College stood a restaurant called The Whim. For generations, this friendly, unpretentious establishment had been a favourite student haunt for good cheap suppers and long, lazy Sunday brunches. One day, quite unexpectedly, it closed down and covered itself in scaffolding. 2 weeks later, it reopened as something I had never seen or experienced before, a fast food burger bar. Still called The Whim, it was now the home of the new Wimbo Burger, two beef patties smothered in a slightly tangy, slightly sweet, creamy sauce, topped with slices of gherkin, slapped into a triple decking of sesame seed bunnage, and presented on a styrofoam tray to the accompaniment of chips called fries and whipped-up ice cream called milkshakes. The tills had preset buttons on them that allowed the perkily paper-capped assistants to press a button for Wimbo, say, and another for milkshake or fries, and all the prices would be automatically registered and calculated. It was like entering an alien spaceship, and I'm sorry to say that I loved it to distraction. A ritual was established. Hugh, Katie, Kim and I, after spending much of the afternoon in A2, playing chess, talking and smoking, would leave Queen's, walk along King's Parade to Trinity Street and into the Whim, then on to the Footlights clubroom, cheerfully swinging our catch, two carrier bags crammed with steaming Whimmery. I could happily manage two Wimbos, a regular order of fries and a banana milkshake. Hugh's standard intake was three Wimbos, two large orders of fries, a chocolate milkshake, and whatever Katie and Kim, who were more delicate, had failed to finish. His years of rowing and the enormously high calorific output they had demanded of him had given Hugh a colossal appetite and a speed of ingestion that to this day stagger all who witness them. I do not exaggerate when I say that he can eat a whole 24-ounce steak in the time it would take me, a much faster-than-average eater myself, to cut and swallow two mouthfuls. When he returned from his daily river work during his boat race year, Katie would cook just for him a cottage pie to a recipe for six people on which she would place four fried eggs. He would polish this off before she had a chance to make a dent in her own soup and salad. I was rather fascinated by the levels of fitness Hugh had attained for the boat race. It is much, much longer than a standard regatta course and requires enormous stamina, strength and will to complete. "At least while you were regularly rehearsing for it," I remember saying to him once, "you must have gloried in the feeling of being so fit." "Hmm," said Hugh, pausing only to point out that we preferred the word training to rehearsing, "I have to tell you that the fact is you never really feel fit at all. You train so hard you are constantly in a dopey state of numb torpor. On the river you slap and sting yourself into action and heave to, but when that's over you're torpid again. In fact, the whole thing's pointless bloody agony." "Which is why," I said, "it is best left to convicts and galley slaves." For all that, how proud I would be if I had ever done something so extraordinarily demanding, so appallingly hard, so wildly extreme as train and row in the boat race. In the clubroom, after the last traces of Wimbo and milkshake had been dealt with, Hugh would play at the piano, and I would watch him with a further mixture of admiration and envy. He's one of those people with the kind of faultless ear for music that allows him to play anything fully and properly harmonised without sight of a score. In fact, he cannot really read music. The guitar, the piano, the mouth organ, the saxophone, the drums, I've heard him play them all, and I've heard him singing with a blues voice that I would sacrifice my legs to have. It ought to be most annoying, but in fact, I'm insanely proud. It is a matter of extreme good fortune that, handsome as Hugh is, prodigiously gifted as he is, funny and charming and clever as he is, I have never felt an erotic stirring for him. How catastrophic, how painfully embarrassing that would have been, how disastrous for my happiness, his comfort, and any future we might have had together as comedy collaborators. Instead, our instant regard and liking for each other developed into a deep, rich and perfect mutual love that the past 30 years has only strengthened. The best and wisest man I have ever known, as Watson writes of Holmes. I shall stop before I get all teary and stupid. Comedy credits. In the clubroom, I ran my first smoker, furiously writing much of the material for it myself, terrified that the evening would run short. The Anthony Blunt Cambridge spy scandal was still being talked of at the time, so amongst other pieces, I wrote a sketch about a don, me, recruiting an undergraduate, Kim, for the Secret Service. I also wrote a series of quickies, mostly in the form of physical sight gags. Everything seemed to go magically well that night, and I was deliciously pleased and filled with a powerful new sense of confidence, as if I had discovered a whole new set of muscles I never knew I had. A few days later, I received a letter in the post from an assistant on the BBC's successful new sketch show Not the 9 o'clock News, which was in the process of making household names of Rowan Atkinson and his co-stars. One of the show's producers, an ex-footlighter called John Lloyd, had been in the audience of My Smoker and seen a quickie which he thought would work well on Not. Could they buy it? In a fever of excitement, I typed it out. A man finishes a pee in a urinal. He goes to the sink, washes himself, and looks for a towel. There isn't one. He looks for anything he might dry his hands on. Nothing. He sees a man standing by the wall. He approaches him and knees him in the groin. The man doubles up with a huge exhalation of pain, in the hot blast of which our hero happily dries his hands. Yes, I know. Read out like that, it's pretty lame. But it had worked okay that evening in front of the smoker audience, and it worked okay when Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones performed it on Not the 9 o'clock News a month or so later. Over the years, it was repeated many times and included in various best-of compilations. I got used to receiving, right up to the end of the decade, cheques from the BBC for randomly absurd sums. Pay Stephen Fry the sum of £1.07, and so on. The lowest was 14p for sales to Romania and Bulgaria. Just after I'd sent off that written version of the quickie, Hugh arrived in A2 for his usual chess chat and coffee. I proudly told him the news that I was now a television writer. His face fell. "Well, that means we can't do it now," he said, his eyes supplying the phrase that his mouth was too polite to add. "You daft tit." "Oh. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Of course. Damn. Bother. Arse." I'd been so excited about selling material to television that it had never occurred to me that it meant we would now not be able to use it ourselves. Not thinking is one of the things I'm best at. All the same, when I saw my name included in the end credits of the episode in which my quickie appeared, I did feel huggingly happy. When the time came for the late-night Memoirs of a Fox to go on at the ADC, Emma, Kim, Paul, Hugh and I were in the show, and Hugh added to the cast a tall, blonde, slender and extraordinarily talented girl called Tilda Swinton. She was not a part of Cambridge's comedy world, such as it was, but she was a magnificent actress, and her poise and presence made her the perfect judge in an American courtroom sketch that Hugh had devised with some very slight assistance from me. It is rather perfect to think of the pair of them playing American characters as students on the stage of the ADC. We would have called you mad if you had suggested that one day Hugh would go on to win Golden Globes for playing an American in a television series, and that Tilda would win an Oscar for playing an American in a feature film. Cook. The previous term, Joe Wade, who was secretary of the Mummers, had drawn my attention to the fact that the Lent term would see the 50th anniversary of the club, which had been founded in 1931 by a young Alistair Cook. "We should have a party," said Joe, "and we should invite him." Alistair Cook was known for his 13-part documentary and book, A Personal History of the United States, and his long-running and greatly loved radio series, Letter from America. We wrote to him, care of the BBC, New York City, USA, wondering if he had any plans to be in Britain in the next few months, and if so, whether he might be amenable to being persuaded to be our guest of honour at a dinner for the semi-centennial celebrations of the drama club he may remember founding. A drama club, we added, that was stronger and healthier than ever, having picked up more fringe firsts in Edinburgh than any other university drama society in the land. He wrote back with the news that he had no plans to be in Britain. "However, plans can be changed. Your letter has so delighted me that I shall fly myself over to be with you." In the dining hall of Trinity Hall, he sat between me and Joe and talked wonderfully of his time at Jesus College in the late 20s and early 30s. He spoke of Jacob Bronowski, who had been in the rooms above him. "He invited me to a game of chess, and as we sat down, asked me, 'Do you play classical chess or hypermodern?' He spoke of his friendship with Michael Redgrave, who succeeded Cook as editor of Granta, Cambridge's most intelligent student publication. As he spoke, he noted down a few words on his napkin. When it was time to propose the toast to Mummers and its next 50 years, he rose to his feet and, on the basis of those 3 or 4 scribbled words, delivered a 35-minute speech in perfect Letter from America style. Michael Redgrave and I were most annoyed that women were not allowed to act in plays in Cambridge. We were tired of those pretty Etonians from King's playing Ophelia. We thought the time had come to change all that. I went to the mistresses of Girton and Newnham and proposed the formation of a serious new drama club in which women might be allowed to take on women's roles. The mistress of Girton was P.G. Woodhouse's aunt or cousin or something, I seem to remember, and she was terrifying but kind. Once she and the Newnham mistress had satisfied themselves that our motives were pure, aesthetic and honourable, which of course they only partly were, they consented to allow their undergraduates to appear in drama. And that is how the Mummers came about. Once the word got out that there was a new club which allowed women to act, hundreds of male undergraduates besieged me, begging to be cast in our first production. I remember holding auditions. One undergraduate from Peterhouse came to see me and recited a speech from Julius Caesar. "Tell me," I said to him as kindly as I could, "what subject are you reading?" "Architecture," he replied. "Well, you carry on with that," I said. "I'm sure you'll be an excellent architect." He did indeed get a first in architecture. But whenever I see James Mason now, he says to me, "Damn, I should have taken your advice and stayed with architecture." The fluency, charm, and ease with which Cook spoke held the entire hall completely spellbound. He was one of those people who seemed to have been born to bear witness. Famously, he had been in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles in 1968, only yards from Robert F. Kennedy, when he was shot down and killed. He told us the story of another brush with political destiny that had taken place during the long vac that followed his setting up of the Mummers. I went with a friend on a walking tour of Germany. It was the kind of thing one did then, books strapped up in an arrangement of leather belts and slung over the shoulder as one tramped the meadows of Franconia, stopping off at taverns and guesthouses. We arrived in a small Bavarian valley late one morning and found a perfect beer garden, overlooked by a pretty old inn which tumbled with geraniums and lobelias. As we sat sipping our steins of lager, chairs were being arranged in rows in the garden. It seemed that some sort of concert was in the offing. By and by, 2 ambulances drew up. The drivers and stretcher-bearers got out, yawned, lit cigarettes, and stood by the open tailgates of their vehicles, as if it was the most normal thing in the world. People began to arrive, and soon every chair in the beer garden was taken, and the dozens who couldn't get a seat stood at the back or sat cross-legged on the grass in front of the small temporary stage. We simply could not imagine what was going to happen. An enthusiastic crowd, but no musicians, and most strangely of all, those ambulance drivers and stretcher-bearers. At last, a pair of huge open-topped Mercedes Tourers arrived, crammed like a Keystone Cop car, with more uniformed figures than they could comfortably hold. They all leapt out, and one of them, a short man in a long leather coat, marched to the stage and began to speak. Not speaking German at all well, I could not understand much of what he said, but I could make out the repeated phrase, "Fünf Minuten bis Mitternacht, 5 minutes bis Mitternacht, 5 minutes to midnight, 5 minutes to midnight." It was almost strange. Before long, women in the crowd would swoon and faint, and the stretcher-bearers would start forward to collect them. What kind of speaker was it who could be so guaranteed to cause people to faint with his words that ambulances came along beforehand? When the man had finished speaking, he strode up the aisle, and his elbow barged against my shoulder as I leant out to see him go, and he backed into me, turned away as he was to take the ovation of the crowd. He immediately grabbed my shoulder to stop me from falling. "Entschuldigen Sie, mein Herr," he said. "Excuse me, sir." For some years afterwards, whenever he came on in the cinema newsreels as his fame spread, I would say to the girl next to me, "Hitler once apologized to me and called me sir." When the evening was over, Alistair Cook shook my hand goodbye and held it firmly, saying, "This hand you are shaking once shook the hand of Bertrand Russell." "Wow," I said, duly impressed. "No, no," said Cook, "it goes further than that. Bertrand Russell knew Robert Browning." Bertrand Russell's aunt danced with Napoleon. That's how close we all are to history. Just a few handshakes away. Never forget that. As he left, he tucked an envelope in my pocket. It was a cheque for £2,000 made out to the Cambridge Mummers. On a compliment slip with it, he had written, "A small proportion to be spent on production, the rest for wine and senseless riot." Chariots 2. One morning in February, Hugh came into A2, waving a letter. "You were in that film they made here, weren't you?" he said to me and Kim. "Chariots of Fire, you mean? Well, they've got some sort of premiere at the end of March and a party at the Dorchester Hotel, and they want the footlights to be the entertainment. What do you think?" "It would make sense if we could actually see the film first, so we could do a sketch about it, or at least make some kind of reference." Hugh consulted the letter. "They're suggesting we go to London on the morning of the 30th, go to the screening for film critics that's taking place in the afternoon, rehearse in the hotel ballroom, and then we'll be put on after the dinner." The day before taking the train to London, I called my mother to tell her what we were up to. "Oh, the Dorchester," she said. "I haven't been to the Dorchester for years. In fact, I remember the last time clearly. Your father and I went to a ball, and it broke up early because the news of John F. Kennedy's assassination came through, and nobody felt like carrying on." On the appointed day, the Corps footlights team settled down in an empty cinema for the screening of the film, quite expecting to be depressed by a low-budget British embarrassment. As we came out, I brushed a tear from my cheek and said, "Either I'm in a really odd mood, or that was rather fantastic." Everybody else seemed to be in agreement. We hastily put together an opening sketch in which we ran onto the stage in slow motion. Steve Edis, whose ear was every bit as good as Hugh's, had absorbed Vangelis's distinctive musical theme and reproduced it on the piano. After hanging about for hours in a small dining area set aside for toastmasters in red mess jackets and what used to be called the upper servants, we were at last on. "My lords, ladies and gentlemen," said the MC into his microphone, "they twinkled in the 20s and now they're entertaining in the 80s. It's the Cambridge University Footlights." Our slow-mo running on stage to Steve's lusty rendition of the film score went extremely well, and from the opening explosions of laughter and applause, we settled confidently into our material. At some stage, however, it became apparent that we were losing the audience. There was rustling, murmuring, chair scraping and whispering. Dinner-jacketed men and evening-gowned women were scampering towards the back of the ballroom and, well, quite frankly, leaving. Surely we weren't that bad. We had not only performed this in Cambridge, but we'd done evenings at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith. I was prepared to believe that we might not be to everyone's taste, but such a mass walkout seemed like a studied insult. I caught Hugh's eye, which held the wild, rolling look of a gazelle being pulled to earth by a leopard. I dare say my expression was much the same. As we lumbered sweatily off stage, with Paul going forward for his monologue with the brave tread of an aristocrat approaching the guillotine, Emma whispered to us, "Someone's shot Ronald Reagan." "What? All the 20th Century Fox executives have left and gone to the phones." I rang my mother that night. "Well, that's settled then, darling," she said. "No member of this family ever goes to an event at the Dorchester again. It's not fair on America." Corpsing Chorus. Back in Cambridge, Bridget Lama was directing the Marlowe Society production that term, Love's Labour's Lost. This was the straight drama equivalent of the Footlights May Week Review, a big budget, by any standards, production mounted in the Arts Theatre, a splendid professional theatre with an alarming audience capacity of exactly 666. A combination of my persuasive rhetoric and Bridget's natural charm succeeded in securing Hugh for his first Shakespearean role, that of the King of Navarre. I played the character with perhaps the best description in all of Shakespeare's dramatis personae, Don Adriano de Armado, a fantastical Spaniard. Only I wasn't a fantastical Spaniard. For some reason, whenever I attempt Spanish, it comes out as Russian or Italian, or a bastard hybrid of the two. I can manage a Mexican accent acceptably, so my Armado was an inexplicably fantastical Mexican. The major role of Barone was played by a fine second-year actor called Paul Schlesinger, nephew of the great film director John Schlesinger. The play opens with a long speech from the king, in which he announces that he and the leading members of his court shall forswear the company of women for 3 years, dedicating themselves to art and scholarship. Hugh and Paul had one of those uncontrollable laughing problems. They only had to catch each other's eye on stage, and they would be unable to breathe or speak. For the first few rehearsals, this was fine, but after a while, I could see Bridget beginning to worry. By the time it came to the dress rehearsal, it was apparent that Hugh would simply not be able to get out the words of the opening address unless either Paul was off stage, which made a nonsense of the plot, or some imaginative solution to the problem could be found. Threats and imprecations had proved useless. "I'm sorry," each said. "We're trying not to laugh. It's a chemical thing, like an allergy." Bridget hit upon the happy notion of making everyone on stage in that scene, the King, Barone, Dumain, Longueville, and general court attendants, speak the opening lines together as a kind of chorus. Somehow this worked, and the giggling stopped. At the first night party, I heard a senior academic and distinguished Shakespeare scholar congratulate Bridget on her idea of presenting the introductory speech as a kind of communal oath. A superb concept. It made the whole scene come alive. Really quite brilliant. "Thank you, Professor," said Bridget without a blush. "It seemed right." She caught my eye and beamed. Sellotapes and Celebration. The last term arrived. Another May ball, finals of the English Tripos, the May Week Review itself, graduation. Farewell, Cambridge. Hello, world. For the last footlight smoker before we began work on the show itself, I recruited my old friend Tony Slattery, who fitted in with the greatest ease. He tore up the audience with guitar songs and extraordinary monologues of his own devising. One girl, according to the fatalistic janitor figure who looked after the premises, actually wet herself. "There's such a thing," he said as he shook a canister of vim over the damp cushion, "as too funny." I attempted to persuade Simon Beale to join us too, but he had enough singing and drama to fill his diary. I think he felt that comedy shows somehow weren't quite him. With the addition of Penny Dwyer, with whom I had worked in Mama Productions, and who could sing, dance, be funny, and do just about anything, we had a cast to join me, Hugh, Emma, and Paul Shearer for the big one, the May Week Review, that would go on to Oxford and then Edinburgh. I wrote a monologue for myself based on Bram Stoker's Dracula and a two-handed parody of the Barretts of Wimpole Street, in which Emma played Elizabeth, a bed-bound invalid, and I played Robert, her ardent suitor. Hugh and I had both seen and found hilarious John Barton's Shakespeare masterclasses on television, in which he had painfully slowly taken Ian McKellen and David Suchet through the text of a single speech. We put together a sketch in which I did the same with Hugh. So detailed was the textual analysis that we never got further than the opening word, time. Hugh asked the previous year's president, Jan Ravens, to direct us, and we began rehearsals in the clubroom. We put together a closing ensemble sketch in which a ghastly kind of Alan Ayckbourn family playing after-dinner charades breaks down in animosity, revelation and disarray. At some point we must have sat finals, and at another point I must have completed two dissertations, one on Byron's Don Juan, another on aspects of E.M. Forster. I can remember neither, having knocked them both up in two frantic evenings, 15,000 words of drivel typed out at high speed. When the news came that the English results were published, I walked to the Senate House, against the walls of which huge notice boards in wooden frames had been attached. I strained through the crowd of hysterical studentry and found my name in the upper second list. I had scored a dull, worthy, and unexciting 2-1. Peter Holland, a don from Trinity Hall who had supervised me for practical criticism and 17th-century literature, offered consolation. "They re-read you for a first twice," he said. "You came very close. You got good firsts in all your papers, top in Shakespeare again, but a 2-2 in the Forster dissertation and a 3rd in the Byron. That's why they just couldn't do it. Hard luck." The hurt was more to my pride than to my plans. To be honest, Cambridge was right. I'd shown I could fly through written exams against the clock, but the serious work of a dissertation, which required the kind of originality, scholarship and diligence that I either didn't possess or simply couldn't be asked to produce, exposed me for the plausible rogue that I was. Hugh read archaeology and anthropology and got a far more amusing and likeable class of degree. He had been to one lecture, which gave him the material for a quite brilliant monologue about a Bantu hut, but otherwise had not disturbed his professors, written an essay, or entered the faculty library. I think he would be the first to admit that you know more about archaeology and anthropology than he does. The first night of our May Week review came. The show was called The Cellar Tapes, as much a reference to the underground Footlights clubroom in which it was born as to Bob Dylan's Basement Tapes, or any pun on sellotape. Hugh came on stage for the opening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the May Week Review. We have an evening of entertainment of... I got a third, by the way. Sketch comedy, music and... We were underway. The Arts Theatre has one of the best auditoriums for comedy I know. Sitting in a spotlight with a leather book on my lap delivering the Dracula monologue, standing on stage with Hugh for the Shakespeare masterclass, kneeling at the stricken Emma's bedside, pouring tea for Paul Shearer in the MI5 recruitment sketch, all these moments were more pleasurable and thrilling in this theatre, on this occasion, before such an enthusiastic audience than anything I had ever done before. Hugh and I looked at each other after the curtain fell. We knew that, come what might, we had not disgraced the name of Footlights. One night of the 2-week run, the word went round backstage that Rowan Atkinson had been spotted in the audience. I broke the habit of my short lifetime and peeped through at the house. There he was. There could be no mistake. Not the least distinctive set of features on the planet. We all performed with an extra intensity that may have made the show better, or may just as easily have given it rather a hysterical edge. I, for one, was too excited to be able to tell. The great Rowan Atkinson watching us perform. Only a year and a half ago, I had all but vomited with laughter at his show in Edinburgh. Since then, Not the 9 o'clock News had propelled him to major television stardom. He came round backstage to shake our hands, a graceful and kindly act for a man so shy and private. My state of electrified enthrallment stopped me from hearing a single word he said, although Hugh and the others told me afterwards that he had been charmingly complimentary about the evening. 2 nights later, Emma's agent, Richard Armitage, came. "Do you see yourselves," he asked us afterwards, "doing this kind of thing professionally, as a career?" It was all so sudden, strange, and overwhelming. A few terms earlier, I had been happy to wander on as a grizzled soldier or warty old king in productions of Chekhov and Shakespeare. I'd listened to the more serious actors talking about applying for places on the Webber Douglas Academy graduate course, the path that Ian McKellen had taken after Cambridge. Since I had met Hugh and started writing sketches with him, and on my own, I had dared hope that I might perhaps apply one day to BBC Radio for a job as a scriptwriter or assistant producer or something along those lines. About my future as a comic performer, I was less sure, however. All the facial mastery, double takes, clowning and fearless assurance that Hugh and Emma displayed on stage and in rehearsal came much less naturally to me. I was voice and words. My face and my body were still a source of shame, insecurity and self-consciousness. That this Richard Armitage was prepared, keen even, to take me on and shepherd me into a genuine career seemed like astonishingly good luck. I later discovered that, crafty old fox that he was, Richard had sent his youngest client ahead to see us and deliver his opinion, which explained what Rowan had been doing there. Plainly, he had made encouraging enough noises about us for Richard himself to make the